History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. What we've learned is that they don't have to go untold, as long as we're willing to take the initiative to ask a few questions, and more importantly, to take the time to patiently listen as memories that may have been buried for decades begin to emerge again. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves truly inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This past December, of course, we marked the 80th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor, but next weekend will be the 80th anniversary of another significant event, another one of those elements of history that is crucial to remember so that it is not repeated. We're going to focus on it this weekend, so perhaps you'll be able to participate in local observances where you live next weekend. On February 19th, 1942, President Franklin D. Roosevelt issued Executive Order 9066, the end result of which was the incarceration of approximately 120,000 Americans of Japanese ancestry. About two-thirds of them were American citizens born here in this country. In many of the areas where this program airs, Day of Remembrance ceremonies will mark that 80th anniversary. And speaking of our radio affiliates, we're proud to welcome Money Talk 1230 KSBN in Spokane, Washington, to the Hometown Heroes family this week. Spokane was a spot where approximately 2,500 Japanese Americans flocked after 9066 as a bit of a safe haven, but many families never had that opportunity. Uprooted from their homes and taken first to temporary assembly centers and then to long-term holding facilities euphemistically referred to as relocation centers, but more commonly known to those interned there as concentration camps. Manzanar, on the eastern slope of the Sierra Nevada Mountains in Southern California, was the first camp to receive internees. There were 10,000 there by the final year of World War II, and Manzanar remains the most well-preserved of the 10 camps. It is now a National Historic Site operated by the National Park Service. And if you head there to Manzanar next weekend, you can mark this 80th anniversary by taking in the Go for Broke Spirit photo exhibit by Shane Sato. Sato has published two books of portraits totaling more than 150 Nisei veterans of World War II, some of whom have shared their stories here on Hometown Heroes. And this special exhibit at Manzanar will feature nine larger-than-life portraits and the corresponding biographies. At hometownheroesradio.com, I have links to that and a list of other upcoming Day of Remembrance events. Some of them feature World War II veterans. Many of them feature Dr. Mitch Mackey, who leads the Go for Broke National Education Center, whose ongoing traveling exhibit, Courage and Compassion, which we've talked about before on Hometown Heroes, will soon reach the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex and be there through June of this year at the Dallas Holocaust and Human Rights Museum. That powerful exhibit makes it quite clear that if this kind of injustice to American citizens could happen 80 years ago, it could happen again in this country if we fail to be vigilant. Over the years on Hometown Heroes, we've heard quite a few Nisei veterans share their memories, giving the rest of us a sense of just how significant the disruption to their lives, their families, and their fortunes was. You can link to all of those interviews at hometownheroesradio.com, from 442nd Regimental Combat Team veterans like Medal of Honor recipient Joe Sakato or Purple Heart recipient Lawson Sakai, to military intelligence service veterans who ended up in the Pacific like Clarence Suzuki or Sherman Kishi. But today I want to zero in on Sam Terasaki's story. I had the privilege of meeting Sam in Denver several years ago, and the way he articulated not only his own experience, but the broader view of that era is very powerful. What a contrast from a young man initially classified as 4C, enemy alien and unable to serve, to marching to the White House at the end of the war to have President Harry Truman brave the rain and pin a presidential unit citation on the 442 flag. But we're going to go back to what started it all. When Imperial Japan attacked Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, Sam Terasaki was a 17-year-old senior at Denver East High School during an era in which there were only around 3,000 Japanese Americans in the entire state of Colorado.
While they called an all-school assembly, they called, three or four of us into the principal's office without telling us why, and we sat in the principal's office. Turned out that one of the speakers, and this was post-December 7th, the featured speaker that day was Mrs. Gates, whose family ran the Charles Gates tire manufacturing business in Denver. They owned a winter home in Hawaii, and she was in Hawaii, I guess, during the December 7th attack.
Wow.
Turns out, I guess, the speech was some propaganda that actually some things that she felt were going on that proved later on to be false, like cutting arrows in the cane fields and sabotage by the Nisei and stuff like that.
Wow. But you didn't get to hear the speech?
I didn't find out about the speech until later on.
So they didn't want any students of Japanese descent hearing what she was saying?
Yeah. December 7th, I was out rabbit hunting with my brother, one of my brothers, and his friend, Joe Morshige, who was killed in the war, I think in Italy or France. We went rabbit hunting with our .22 rifles, and it was a weird thing. We actually went around the outskirts of what was a new air base called Laurie Field. It had moved here from Illinois, and relatively new. I think it moved here sometime in 1937 or something. We didn't know anything about the start of the war until we got home. But in hindsight, I imagine three guys with rifles trying to tell officials that we were hunting rabbits when we're circling around a military base.
I know we're going to hear some stories that are going to amaze us at how you survived in Europe, but it's somewhat surprising you survived that if you're a young Japanese-American with a gun by an Air Force base. So then you get home and you hear it on the radio or your folks tell you?
Yeah. And then I don't know how long later, whether it was a day or 2 days or a week, but the FBI came to our home, interviewed each one of us separately.
Wow.
I was 17 years old, scared as hell. And, you know, you hear a lot about the FBI. And I guess one of the big radio shows at that time was Gangbusters.
What'd they ask you? What kind of stuff were they trying to get out of you?
Well, I don't remember. It's just want to know if we were loyal and what we were up to.
And you had mentioned your father had done a lot of business with businessmen from Japan.
Yeah. They didn't throw him into camp, but they did throw several, like local Buddhist priests and stuff, were sent to a separate camp.
So December 7th happens. The FBI comes to your home, interviews everybody, and I'm sure you're afraid of what's going to happen. But then a couple months later, the president issues this 9066, this executive order, basically saying that if you're a Japanese American on the West Coast, you're an enemy alien, and you're out here in Colorado. Were you concerned that they were going to put you in a camp, put your whole family in a camp?
No, it never struck me. I really don't know why. It might have been because we didn't live in the Japanese community in Denver. We lived, I think there was only two families that lived in East Denver then. No, it didn't concern me at all, although I was aware of them being thrown into camp,
Did that make you angry to know that these people, just because of their last name or their appearance?
No, just wondered why. I didn't face any discrimination for the few months later that I was in high school until I graduated in June of 42. Although some of the fellow students just maybe were afraid to get too involved with me. All of my friends were of Caucasian descent. A lot of my closest friends were actually Jewish kids that went to the school. I don't remember any of them ever coming up and say, "Sam, don't worry, we're with you," and stuff like that. But on the other hand, they never turned their backs on me either. So I was fortunate in that sense.
And how'd you end up in the Army?
Well, I was drafted. You know the story about being designated an enemy alien.
Yeah.
Well, that's it. See, in 1942, I should have been drafted right away. I was 17, 18 then, 1A classification. It was in the spring of 42. They changed the classification from 1A to 4C.
Right.
I didn't fight it. I'm 4C, I'm 4C.
It didn't bother you that this country you're born in is calling you an enemy alien and unfit to serve?
No, I said to hell with them.
You just stay out of the way and keep your nose down.
I decided I was going to work a couple of years and go to university.
Mm-hmm.
If they wanted me, they have to come after me. I wasn't about to volunteer, mainly because I knew I had a hunch of where we would end up.
Really? What was that hunch?
That we couldn't join the Air Force, we couldn't join the Navy, couldn't join the Marines or the Merchant Marine. We were headed for the Army and the part of the Army that I didn't like. If I had had a chance to, actually, after I was inducted, I volunteered for the Air Force, but they wouldn't. So I volunteered for the Navy. I hate ships, but I volunteered just to stay out of being designated infantryman.
Right. Because you knew what that meant.
Yeah.
But you're saying you saw that coming. You figured that you guys would be the expendable ones?
Well.
Or that they were going to need some bodies at some point?
You don't want to go in the infantry during a hot war. They were so hard up for replacements for the 442nd and the 100th Infantry Battalion that from the day I was inducted until I first heard my enemy shell coming over my head was less than 6 months.
Wow.
Yeah, that was May of 44. Went to Camp Shelby, Mississippi for basic training in June of 44. And they sent us home for 2 week furlough. While I was home, one of the cadre from Mississippi, who was a Colorado boy, came home and called me up. And I knew of him, but I didn't know him that well. And he says, Sam, you better be sure and tell your folks hello, because as soon as you get back, you're going to be shipped overseas. That's first I heard of that. And it turned out that was the way it was. After my furlough was over, I went back to Mississippi, and they'd already had the mattress bag. You fill it up. And we were shipped out on a troop train to Camp Shanks, New York.
You shared with us how you were able to avoid the internment, your time here in Denver. You've got a couple of years of freedom that a lot of Japanese Americans didn't have.
No, they didn't.
But then you get to Camp Shelby, and you're around a whole lot of Japanese Americans who have been in the camps.
When I was inducted at Fort Logan in Colorado, there might have been a dozen in our group, I'm not sure. Half of them were people that grew up in the farm communities north of Denver, a couple of whom I knew. The other half came out of one of the relocation camps, Camp Amachi, which is in southeastern Colorado.
Right.
I made friends with one of the fellows that came out of Amachi. I didn't know him from Adam, and he lived in California before the evacuation. So we had a friendship until we both ended up in the 100th Battalion when we were shipped overseas. I was in A Company and he was in C Company. We survived France, and when we were shipped back to Italy, well, he was killed back in Italy.
Mm-hmm. What was his name?
Bob Suoyoka. I have a picture of him, and I never have been able to locate any member of his family. You do what you're supposed to do. I wondered why it was me and not the guy next to me that got wounded or killed. I was fortunate that I got through the war without a scratch. In retrospect, I think being classified 4C may have saved my life, because I would have been drafted right away and would have been ended up in the 442nd very early on and shipped overseas when the regiment went overseas. As it was, by the time I joined as a replacement, I had missed one of the big battles, the rescue of the Lost Battalion and
right.
The capture of these two French towns, Biefontaine and Bruyères.
And that's the signature achievement of the 442, or the one that gets the most publicity, because
yes, right.
There were more members of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team killed and wounded than there were mostly Caucasian soldiers from that Lost Battalion rescued.
Yeah. Some of the fellows, when I joined up, they had just pulled back from the front lines, and one of the fellows whose brother I had taken basic training with, we looked him up, and sure enough, he was in the medics, and you could see in his eyes the hell that he'd gone through, because I had seen him in Camp Shelby before they shipped out as a replacement themselves. He was in the group of replacements just before me.
So when you saw him over there, you saw a different look in his eye.
Oh, absolutely. You could see that. You could tell that he was through hell.
What was your first taste of combat and what this is really going to be like?
Well, at that time, it was after they'd pulled back from the front lines, and we were so depleted in manpower that they gave us easy duty in southern France. That was from November until the next spring in March of 45. Yeah, all the time our particular company were in the Maritime Alps, I guess is what they call it. It was right on the border of Italy and France.
Right.
And being in a weapons platoon, my job each night was to go up to the outpost on the border and look down into Italy and man a machine gun just in case the Germans came, tried to attack there. Although I was a mortarman by, what do they call it, MOS or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And then when dawn would break, well, then we'd get out of that machine gun nest and come back down the mountain to the backside, into the French side, because they knew that there was a machine gun nest there. In fact, the German artillery had a direct hit on it one day when we were out of the...
So the very position that you occupied the night before or the night after got hit?
It was
during the
daytime.
Day.
Generally, uh-huh. The Germans wouldn't shoot their artillery at night because it would reveal their position.
Right.
Very precisely, where in the daytime they would shell us. And when we went up the next night, we saw the destruction. And it actually was a direct hit.
Wow.
We had a spare 30 caliber machine gun barrel there, and you hold it up and look through it, and you could see a dent on the inside where a shrapnel hit.
That's a pretty direct hit.
Pretty direct hit.
It's time for our first break, but we'll hear more of Sam Terasaki's World War II story when we come back. How will you observe the Day of Remembrance next weekend? Check your local area for events near you and check out the list at hometownheroesradio.com, including one that's getting an early start this weekend with author James Ardize. We told you about his book, Tears of Honor, last year at this time. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.